The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Margaret Kimberly is a columnist and editor for the Black Agenda Report and a longtime friend of the podcast. This week, she returns to discuss yellow vests, open borders, inequality, and the need to develop an alternative to capitalism. The second half of this conversation will be available to our Patreon supporters. It's Thursday, December 20th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books, and the host of this podcast. Starting in the new year, Patreon supporters will get access to the Zero Books podcast and to the Symptomatic Redness podcast every week, while those listening for free will be able to listen to a full-length episode every other week, as we're adopting the Chapo model with the hope of getting more communist dollars and expanding our podcast and video production. When we reach 600 patrons, we'll introduce an additional Commie Ideology for Beginners series that will be, of course, free to everyone. The music you're listening to right now is the Auld Lang Syne 8-bit remix. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Margaret Kimberly discuss yellow vests and the state of the left. So, okay, the yellow vests. So, Margaret, who are they? Who are the yellow vests? Why do they wear yellow vests? And what are their demands?
Well, it's an interesting irony. France requires car owners to have these yellow vests in case of an emergency and you're broken down at the roadside, you can be seen and you won't be run over. So anybody who owns a car has to have a yellow vest. And the final straw of that broke the proverbial camel's back, was the imposition of a gasoline tax. And this was on top of, for years, now, and it didn't just start with Macron, it started with Sarkozy and other presidents and the previous supposedly socialist Hollande, who was just a one-term guy. But France was always known for its generous public assistance, its generous welfare state, and that's how I had always thought of it. But like other capitalist countries, they have been whittling away at their system of benefits, at job protection. Macron even lowered tax. There was a wealth tax, and he got rid of it. So finally, this gasoline tax. And people were encouraged to buy diesel cars. Apparently, they're less polluting, and people were encouraged to buy diesel, and which is more expensive, and then they tax the diesel. And so people used this something they all had, this yellow vest, as a symbol of their protest. It was triggered by this last tax on gasoline, but it was as part of a larger problem. They have been slowly privatizing their health care system. All of the things that are happening, I'm learning, the things we're seeing in the United States are, you can see in other capitalist countries as well.
Right. And in UK, the NHS is also slowly being privatized and undermined.
It is. And it's horrible in the UK. Not only are they privatizing their national health care system, they're pretty much decimated their public assistance system. And people, of course, are living in poverty. It's very difficult to claim disability benefits. There were a tax on immigrants, mostly who originally came from the Caribbean, people who had been accepted as legal immigrants were suddenly rendered stateless and were not eligible for benefits, not able to work. People who had worked for years and paid taxes for years suddenly were without any help. So these are things that are happening everywhere. And so it's been a lesson for me about what's happening around the world, things that are peculiar to France, but also things that are part of a larger dynamic that's happening in so many different places.
Yeah, there's a global trend, I think, right now of unrest, I would say, or lack of confidence in the system. And it takes expression in various different ways. You know, based on the particular histories and cultures that you're talking about. But I always like to look at the biggest picture I can, because that way I have simple abstractions to work with rather than lots of details that my mind will like go of too quickly. So then I have to ask you this. According to a report on Europe One, which is a French radio station, 42% of the self-identified yellow vest participants voted for Le Pen in the last election, while only 20% voted for the left-wing candidate Mélenchon, and only 5% voted for Macron. Now, Le Pen is a candidate in the far-right National Rally or National Front Party, and that's the party that wants to make France more French and that wants to restrict immigration. There's an anti-Semitic streak in the party. Its history is deplorable. So should we think of the Yellow Vest movement as maybe half reactionary or mostly reactionary?
Well, you know, it's interesting because their demands and their concerns are things that should concern the left. The fact that people are having their protections removed and their taxes raised and the rich getting richer because of government policies. These are issues that the left can get behind and join in opposing. But there is a complication here, as you point out. Le Pen is she and her father were leaders of this right wing party, anti immigrant party. But ironically, Le Pen is in favor of a generous welfare state. She just wants it for white people. So she was opposed to these austerity measures. And that is a contradiction. You don't want to be certainly supportive of her, but at the same time, their demands are things that are quite reasonable to me. So it doesn't fit neatly into any particular category. I'm also learning, I thought of French labor unions as being, I mean, they're stronger than the U.S., but, you know, that's actually damning with faint praise, isn't it? But they, you know, people there protest. It seems to be something that was not, protest has been pretty much disappeared from the U.S. I remember a few years ago, there was a famous case of two executives, I think they were Air France executives, and they were announcing layoffs. And they were attacked by workers, and their clothes were nearly ripped off. I mean, it was a sort of thing that you would not see here ever. And nobody was arrested or punished for it. So that is how I think of French workers. And I did not know, and I'm a little embarrassed at my own ignorance here, that there are so many people there struggling. And that this, while more generous than the U.S., and again, damning with faint praise, there are people there who are low income, and their needs have not been met for many years, if ever. The left in France is kind of a phony left, and that's an issue across Europe. If you look at, you know, Greece, the Syriza party, they gave in to the EU and, you know, they're selling off their country to pay debts that were incurred by the wealthy and so forth. So it looks as though France is the same way. So you don't have a strong left. And I believe the way to fight fascism, the way to fight the right, is to have strong left-wing policies, is to protect people from the predations, the worst of capitalism, to protect people, to force the state to support the population and to treat housing and health care as human rights and things that people should not have to pay for, and, you know, in the United States here, go bankrupt over. So I think that's what fights the right wing, is people being taken care of. And I think that's the answer. I don't think here in the U.S., I don't think fighting Trump is as complicated as we're being made to believe. I think if the, we don't talk about a phony left, my God, here in the U.S., we have a far right party and a center right party. And the idea of Medicare for all that Bernie Sanders and others are promoting, Medicare for all would kill the Republican Party. I shouldn't say that. That's probably overstating the case. But the Democrats could win again if they were all behind Medicare for all, period, the end. They would. And even people, they would peel off a significant number of Republican votes if that were going to happen. But they're beholden to these corporate interests. So this, what seems to me to be something reasonable and sensible, is something that would damage significantly the health insurance companies, the pharmaceutical companies. And they, of course, give money to Democrats and Republicans as a protection racket. So it's something we're probably not going to see. But, you know, there's so much. The reaction to Trump winning is very peculiar to me. People want Democrats, they want to be right-wing anyway, so it's an excuse for them. It's like, well, how do we get the Trump voters? How do we get the Trump voters? We can't be too left-wing, when actually the answer is to be left-wing, is to help people out. That would reverse this tide of Democratic defeats over the last few years. And lest we forget, I always say that Trump's victory was the day of reckoning. That, you know, Democrats had lost over 900 seats in Congress and in state legislatures across the country. So because they have retreated from being, they still have this reputation 50 years after enacting Medicare and Medicaid. They have not, in the years since, really done anything to help people, or very little. And so they have this reputation, or they're supposed, or even, you know, you have this thing in here in the U.S. where people say, well, I know they're not really that much better, but the Republicans are so awful. So many people support them, you know, the lesser evil, or hold your nose and vote for them, that sort of thing. So that's all we have. We don't even have an illusion that we have a party that is really helpful. It's just like, well, this one is less damaging to us. So, but I'm finding that that's the case in many parts of the world, and it's certainly true in France. And that is why this Yellow Vest movement has sprung up. It'll be interesting to see what direction they go in and how the political parties in France respond to this, what's a political crisis. And that's what you always need to have change, is for people to spark a political crisis. And we'll find out what direction that they go in from here.
Back when Trump was running for president, you know, during the 2016 election, I was a member of a Marxist group, which I'm no longer part of. And one of the things the reason why I'm no longer a part of the group was because the organization really felt strongly that the primary objective of the group should be to fight Trump after the election. And I was, of course, not against fighting Trump, but I felt as though we were losing sight of the larger critique that they've been working on, and we've been working on under Obama. Under Obama, we weren't concerned so much with Obama. We were talking about the economic crisis of 2008 and the way capitalism functions and so forth. And then Trump came along, and it seemed to me like we were losing focus and got kind of personally invested in trying to – it just sort of seemed like we were echoing the Democratic Party. And this was not – to say that was, you know, those were fighting words. And it was not a pretty parting. But now that we're a couple years in and I think back on that moment and why – I think about why the Marxists that I was working with wanted to focus on Trump. And it was not simply – kind of an hysterical reaction. It was also that there are – like this group never really embraced Bernie Sanders, for instance, right? And the reason why was because the redistributist policies of Sanders, this sort of new deal approach of Sanders, wasn't deemed to be tenable given the contradictions within capitalism and especially after the economic crisis that – that in fact you could look to Syriza and see that kind of approach to left-wing politics just wasn't going to be able to stand up against not only the ruling classes that were neoliberal, but also the kind of fundamental basic reality of the economy, which we needed to break with rather than try to manage. So this was why, strangely, why there was no left political project to embrace for this group other than trying to hold back the right. But there was no vision for a party that was going to address immediate problems in society, like, say, inequality between workers. And I feel as though we're still as a left stuck. I mean, my response was, well, we need to tactically embrace Sanders. We need to embrace more social democratic approaches to left-wing politics, just because otherwise these divisions between the working class are going to be reinforced and we're never going to be able to organize for something more. It was my thought. But now I'm sort of confused, and I'm not really disagreeing with what you've been saying so far, but I want to complicate it a little bit and just say that, well, I'm going to do something weird. I'm going to quote Milton Friedman, who said that that there's no doubt in free and open immigration is the right policy in a, quote, libertarian state. In other words, like a neoliberal, no regulations, no welfare state kind of state. Everyone, you know, by their bootstraps kind of world. That's what Milton Friedman wanted. But that but under a welfare state, the need for closing the borders becomes more and more pronounced, because you have to worry about how the surplus is being divided up, and the more people you accept in, who may be low skilled, low wage workers you accept in, the more of a strain it's going to be putting on the welfare state, the more the need will arise for strict border control. And so it seems like social democratic redistribution brings with it a nationalist ideology and a nativist strain of thinking.
Right, I see what you mean. It's, people have something, they don't want it to be put at risk. And you don't want other people to get what you've gotten. If they're getting it, puts you at risk of not getting. So that I understand. My argument is, and maybe it's a utopian thought, if you take care of everybody, what's the problem? I think we have, in this country, immigration is a problem because there are so many Americans, so many native-born Americans who are unskilled, who are at the bottom, who are struggling to be employed at all. You also have the complication of racism in the United States, wherein black people are at the bottom always. And if a new immigrant group comes in, they get to be placed above black people. And I think often white people use newcomers as a way to try to manage black people. So they can say, if they hire Latinos, well, we're not racist because this is a person of color. But they still don't hire black people, which is, for this country, that is, I believe, the measure of anti-racist progress, is how black people are treated. So you have people of color who are still elevated above us.
Yeah, in France, it might be a little different than in the United States, do you think? Or the major thing?
Well, you know, it's interesting about France, racism in France. I have a friend, and a black American friend, who lived in France briefly, and he felt that France was very racist, and I was surprised to hear about that. But, you know, I guess I'm living in a kind of time bubble. I think of, you know, people like James Baldwin living in France. And
right, that's what I think of too, right?
And Nina Simone and, you know, the artists who went to France to live to escape American racism.
Didn't Baldwin say that he felt like he was treated like just a human being for the first time ever in France or something like that?
Something like along those lines, yeah. Yes. But I think that was also before there were a large number of immigrants from Africa and the Middle East going to France. So there's always, you know, with black people, there's always this tipping point. You know, there's if there are few black people, everything's okay. There's an actual number, a friend of mine said, that it was like 8% or so. I can't remember the actual number, where the number of black people causes change and causes racist sentiment and policies to be enacted.
Is black defined the same way in France? Does it take in more people than it might in the United States?
Good question. Good question. It might not just be Africans. It could be people from the Middle East. France had all these colonies, in Africa and Morocco and Algeria and places. All parts of Africa, I mean to say, North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa as well. So I don't know if black means someone from Ivory Coast or if it also means someone from Algeria. I'm not sure. I have to be honest, but there have been incidents where the police have, you know, when the police kill somebody in France, it's always a black person who dies. And reading an article that I just got this morning, a black man was killed by police. He was he died like Eric Garner. He was asphyxiated. He was running from the police because he didn't have his ID. And it turns out in France, you can be arrested if you don't have ID on you, of course, but black people are the only ones who are asked. So there is a problem with racism there as well. But going back to the issue of immigration here, it's what Friedman says it is complicated by race in this country. And because we have this society where people aren't guaranteed work, and where despite legislation, people are discriminated against quite regularly, newcomers can come in and be placed above people here. And you also have the issue of a country that is very much not generous, where everybody feels in a precarious position. Unless you're really rich, I think it's fair to say that most Americans don't feel secure. And the presence of a new group just heightens that fear. And I think the America's history is this settler colonial state, as a friend of mine said to me, you know, in that kind of country, everybody's a potential enemy. So it's hard to feel solidarity with anybody because everyone's a competitor. If there are additional competitors and they're from another place and they're a different race and they don't speak the language, it's easier to feel even more insecure.
What you just said about new immigrants being put ahead of the African American population that's been here forever makes me think about something else that Milton Friedman said, which is that the only good kind of immigration with a welfare state is illegal immigration. that way you don't have to give them any access to food stamps or unemployment insurance or any of that. And if you throw in this idea that there's a black struggle going on amongst the native population for equality, there might be very much a feeling within the black community that the last thing they want is to naturalize a whole bunch of illegal immigrants who will then get ahead of them in line for jobs and equal rights in the society that they built.
Exactly. And also, there's an additional complication with black people where I notice here in New York where we have a large I've read that about a third of New Yorkers were born outside of the United States. We have a very large immigrant population, people from all over the world. I'm noticing sometimes that black people from the Caribbean, there are many people here from the Caribbean nations, now we're getting an greater influx of Africans in the healthcare field, for example. And if you go to a hospital or a nursing home, the black people who are employed are not Americans. They almost all have a West Indian accent, a few Africans, and I say to myself, well, there's nothing about being a nurse's aide in a nursing home that, you know, you have to be from Jamaica or Trinidad in order to do. So it's an interesting thing. There are all these ways of dividing people. I think black people who are native born are the ones viewed with the greatest hostility and fear. And people from other places can be seen as being slightly different. And they can be elevated, and some of them will go along with that. You always hear about the hardworking West Indians as though no black American ever worked hard or had more than one job or any of these things they're always credited with, which they have all the behaviors of other immigrant groups. But so it's harder to pigeonhole them with a lot of the racist tropes that are directed against native-born black people. So we have these further complications, but I think it's interesting that people here who are undocumented can't benefit from the welfare state. I think it's interesting that people, I had an almost argument with a friend of mine because she insisted that undocumented people can get Medicaid. And I was telling her, no, they can't. They can if an undocumented person gets hit by a car and ends up in the emergency room, Medicaid will end up paying. But they can't sign up and get the benefits that someone who is here legally or a citizen or even a green card holder, they can't. But people insist that they are getting stuff that they're not getting. So many of them are, in fact, working. Many of them work off the books, or they get fake ID, or they share an ID with a friend who's – I had a friend from who was from Trinidad, and he had a friend come up who didn't have his paper, so he let the friend use his Social Security number and work. So that's how many people do these things. So ironically, there are people who are working but who won't be eligible for the benefits, their programs they're paying into. I think people, I don't know, I don't understand. I think people come here, they hope there's going to be another amnesty, which I don't see. There was one when Reagan was president, ironically. There was an amnesty for undocumented people, but I don't see that happening again. But they, you know, people just, I think, sort of hope, or they marry an American. I've joked that half the marriages in New York are for green cards, but at any rate, so those are the things that immigrant groups, people, they don't get what people think they can get, although they can end up doing well. There are certain sectors of the economy here that are almost all, and it's kind of odd, you know, immigrant groups, a certain group will take over a certain field or industry, and native-born people live in resentment, or some people are racist, or if they're people of color, just the resentment that others come and get something that used to be theirs. For example, there is New York City traffic enforcement agents, the people who write tickets. And for years, the people who had those jobs were all black Americans. And then all of a sudden, they were South Asian. Now I've heard people say they're Bangladeshi, and someone told me they're from Sri Lanka. Somebody else says, no, they're Pakistani. I'm not sure where they're from. They are South Asian people. They are not. And it was a very noticeable change. And now most of the traffic enforcement agents you see belong to this group. So these jobs are not high paying, but it has benefits, pension, all of the things that people need, the things that are becoming less and less common, is a job that's been lost to us. So that's the sort of thing that that concerns people. And, you know, most people don't want to be racist, but you don't want to be a chump either. And you don't want to act as though these things that you see aren't happening. So now in France, it's unclear to me. I would like to find out. I suspect, and this is pure conjecture on my part, I think these are people who are well-educated in their country. I think they probably get a leg up on these. It's a civil service test kind of job. And I suspect that is what happens. And immigrants, a lot of groups, they do things as a group. And somebody says, you know, they're given this test for the traffic enforcement agent, and people from country X all get in. And if they're people who have more education someplace else, then they have a leg up on these exams. That's the thing that I believe happened. And I'm also admitting that as a guess.
You know, I'm going to say something off to the side of this a little bit, but I have a friend who is a postal worker, and I have another friend who's just took the test to become a postal worker. They're both white people, you know, and they're both college educated. And in both cases, it's sort of a D-class A move, but they're all very thrilled, and given their current circumstances, to be in the post office. It's a great job. There's good union benefits and all of that. But I also know that it was also a really good job for black people in Portland.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. Yes, I'm sure that's true, and you're absolutely right. That was a job. I think it's one of the reasons that government employment has been under attack, because they have been black people's jobs. They were jobs where you could get a living wage. You didn't have to have a college education or a specific skill, but you could still get a living wage position. So the austerity and the cutbacks have really, really hurt us more. And as you point out, you know, these friends of yours who in years past would have been able to count on a private sector job or a different government job, a different public sector position. But now this is a good deal for them. And so you can't tell them not to do it, but we should be mindful of the people who used to do it. And just to tell people, as you said, gentrification in the job market, it's like, well, you know, everybody, it's a free country, everybody gets to do what they want, but everybody doesn't get
it's
to do what
really
they want.
It's not really gentrification, because those jobs are not going to suddenly, you know, be millionaire positions or something because white people take them, right?
In a downwardly mobile society, anything with any security is now like, it's like grabbing the brass ring.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, so those are the complications here, about immigration. And immigration is, you know, it's a funny thing that people think about, that immigrants just come in and get stuff. I met a young woman last week at a Christmas party. She was from the Caribbean, from Barbados. And she'd come here as a student. She'd gone to one of the universities here in New York, and she told me that she had to pay $8,000 for a chance to be in a lottery, which didn't, to get a certain visa, which allows her to work. And she said, you're not guaranteed that you're going to get anything. You have to pay this money. She said her family was able to, you know, give her this $8,000, which is a lot of money, $8,000. For an opportunity to maybe be able to stay here and work. And she was fortunate enough to win. But this idea that immigrants are, you know, they have it easy and they just come in and they just get jobs, and although they do get some jobs, you know, the numbers of people who I believe who work off the books is I think is significant. and the people who, by hook and by crook, get some kind of fake ID and are able to work when they're not supposed to be working, I think is significant, too. But I think it also points to the precariousness of people in this country, and it's something here that is not talked about. The poverty, I'm sure you've seen the statistics. Most Americans can't cope with a $1,000 emergency. That half the population is, making less than $35,000. I mean, you're talking about people really struggling. And so I don't sneer at people either when they have these concerns about immigrants, because their situation is not talked about. It's never discussed. And this, this worshiping of this idea of middle classness and people thinking of themselves as middle class when they may be employed, but they're struggling. And the politicians don't talk about it. They get votes by, Democrats get votes because of their past history. People are thinking about FDR or LBJ, all of which are, many, many decades ago, and Republicans are just up front with their right-wing agenda, and they get votes because they've become they have been the party of white people. And so there's no one addressing the needs of these people. Now, Trump, I believe, was able to peel off votes because he did pretend. He said, I want this to be the party of working people.
A lot of people on the left will sort of pussyfoot around contradictions and problems that arrive with immigration issues. We want to pretend like the only problem is just xenophobia and racism and not the complications of the class system and the divisions between working class people.
Exactly. And so one of the problems is the only people who raise the issue of immigration are racists. And that is not a good thing for other people to just blow it off or point fingers at someone who says, build a wall and make Mexico pay for it. But that's why that little girl from Guatemala died in ICE custody. Nobody's talking about it except the Trumpite people. And that's not a good thing for many reasons. You're ignoring the concerns that other people have, you don't address the problem, and you act as though everything is okay and that there's nothing wrong with immigration at all. And anybody who raises any issue is just a racist. And if they're the only ones who ever talk about it, then that's how it would appear. And that's not good. But
yeah, a few years ago, one of my favorite socialist philosophers, Slavoj Žižek, was pilloried for raising exactly this point, which is that we can't just stake out a moral position for, say, open borders and leave it at that if we want to actually hold on to power and convince people who, should be part of a mass movement that we actually have some sort of vision for where we want society to go. But he got a lot of heat for that because he was questioning open borders in a way that I guess was maybe it was just easy to misinterpret. And recently, one of our authors, I think, really stepped in it. And I have to question, and this might not be in the podcast because handling this exactly right is part of my job. But Angela Nagel, who wrote a book called Kill All Normies, recently wrote a book, wrote an essay called A Leftist Case Against Open Borders, and then went on Tucker Carlson to talk about it. And propaganda-wise and just optics-wise, it was the absolute worst thing to do. And she's Irish, not American, so maybe she didn't quite understand who Tucker Carlson is. But what he's doing when he brings on a leftist like her. But it also, though, my complaint for that piece would have been, and okay, I'm going to start it like this. My complaint about people who do question that open borders kind of tenet, a kind of religiously held position for open borders, is that when it is questioned, it isn't questioned from the perspective of a socialism that wants to be international, that wants to, in the end, have open borders, in the end, have a working class that's mobile across national boundaries, in the end, that, you know, wants to bring people together in solidarity as working people, despite their nationality or ethnicity. It doesn't, we lose sight of how to hold on to that. And I think the reason we do is precisely because of some of the contradictions we're living with and the problems we're living with today that we've been talking about. So how do you think we should like hold on to an internationalist vision for the future and at the same time not just have sort of symbolic positions on something like open borders?
Well, I think there are other issues that have to be addressed. I think and it's hard for white people in France or Britain, they don't want to hear this, but if their countries hadn't colonized half the world, these people wouldn't be there. And if it's okay for, why is it okay for the sun to never set on the British Empire, but people can't move from Jamaica to the UK? Why the same thing for France? And it's like, sorry, nobody wants to talk about that history that's so inconvenient. Or the migrant crisis of the last couple of years, that's been caused by imperialist wars. Libya, Muammar Gaddafi, and Europeans paid him to keep African immigrants from crossing through Libya to get to the Mediterranean and then on to Europe. And in destroying, and speaking of France, I'm going off topic a little bit, but Sarkozy, when he was president, he took money from the Libyans, gave him money for his political campaign, and he turned around and helped get Gaddafi killed. So were it not for this criminality on the part of the U.S. and NATO nations, literally those migrants would not be in Europe, or what they did to Syria. Migration has been caused by these imperialist wars, and you disrupt people's lives and then they want to leave, or they always wanted to leave but they couldn't get there before, but thanks to Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama leading the way, they took the lead in destroying Libya, although it was an international effort, now you have migrants. So how do you not talk about that? How do you talk about, you know, Trump is this horrible, evil person, and he is. How do you not talk about Obama and Hillary Clinton? They played a huge role in creating this humanitarian crisis. So there has to be a willingness to talk about the things that have been done historically, which have disrupted people's lives, which have sent people around the world, the hypocrisy that says England and France can go all over the world and establish colonies, but nobody can go, those same people can't go to their countries. So that is a tough discussion that there's very little willingness to have.
Well, even if you want to have it, there's a real problem in like figuring out exactly what to do about it, because first of all, you know, what's past is past. We can't go back and stop like the invasion of Iraq. But more to the point, the inequality between nations seems to be baked into capitalism. Even if it wasn't the United States or Britain, it would be capital would concentrate somewhere and lead to imperial ambitions somewhere, maybe in India or China. The problem is both that we have this national and racial inequality and also criminality and imperial wars, but also that we have a system that kind of incentivizes that, makes that almost inevitable. And that getting it, destroying that system. And since one of our very first conversations, Margaret, I've been saying we need to think past capitalism, but then I would say, and I have no idea how to do it. And, you know, I feel like I'm talking about saying we need to grow wings or something.
That's a Christmas present from a very dear friend of mine.
Look, Daddy, teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
That's right.
Attaboy, Clarence.